Okay, so yesterday we proved the Lieber-Robinson bounds and we saw they imply no signaling. And today we start with showing another application of the Lieber-Robinson bounds, which is this idea that if you have some local operator OA, so this is our lambda, okay, our collection of degrees of freedom in real space, right? And A is the region in which OA has support. Okay. And so remember, we started our discussion arguing that for every t, no matter how small, non-relativistic quantum mechanics tells us that A has support everywhere, everywhere, instantaneously. And therefore, that's why instantaneously will not commute with B. However, we prove that the Lieber-Robinson bounds are saying actually the non-commutation with B is very tenuous if it is not large enough. So tenuous that it is completely negligible, especially in the continuum limit. So this seems to imply that it would only not really commute only with operators that are within some radius. Let me call this radius L, where L is Vt, right? The Lieber-Robinson speed times T. And then we are tempted to saying, well, actually, if I take OA of T and I truncate it and make a truncation, means I trace out everything that is here outside this bubble, then I have a very good approximation of the full OA of T. Okay? Do you understand the logic? So I will define some OL A of T, and I want to argue that this difference is small. Okay? That I can approximate very well the truncated operator that has support only in a finite region outside A. Basically, this is within the light cone. And everything else that is outside doesn't really matter. Okay, so let's do that. So first of all, let's define what is everything else. So let me call everything else S. Okay, so S is the set of points in lambda. Okay, so help me. What do you think it is?
The distance to A that is more than L.
Great. Such that the distance between X and A, it should be clear what I mean by this, is the minimum grasp distance with points Y that are in A, is greater than L. Okay, so this is S. And as you know, to every collection of degrees of freedom is associated an Hilbert space HS, which is simply the tensor product with X in S over HX, right? Because we have this local structure of the Hilbert space that is the tensor product of local degrees of freedom. Okay. So now that we know what is the rest, then the truncated operator OAL of T is just the trace over S of the full OA. Okay. And so right now I'm doing the usual abuse of notation, but in cases like this, I need to complete my operator with something on S, right? Because this must be an operator everywhere, which is non-trivial only on S. Okay. So I could, since this is a definition, I can put anything I want, right? In fact, I want to put something trivial, but since I can put anything I want, I will put the identity on S over the dimension of S. Why? So what I'm saying is that my operator here is actually like a state. It's the completely mixed state. Okay? So it is this operator that I can argue has very little difference with the total operator. So if I manage to prove this, now you know that every time you have a suitable local system and you have a local operator, then you can always imagine it as just the truncated part. Then you have to complete with a completely mixed state on the rest. Okay?
Why do you want a completely mixed state?
Because for this theorem is true. So I want to find an operator that represents OA of t in arbitrarily well, such that it's non-trivial only in this region. And this operator that does the trick for which we can prove this turns out to be this operator. Okay? Okay. To prove this theorem, we need a tool that we will be exploring properly, because it's a beautiful tool of mathematical physics, but it will take at least one full lecture to explain it, and probably more. And there will be also some more stuff about that in part two of the course. So right now I will just use the tool without proving this thing, but we will see how to prove these things later, okay? So this tool is the Haar measure. How many of you have heard about this thing? Okay, so it's a fairly well-known thing. So you know that this is an extension of the Lebesgue integral on something that are more than just numbers. So it's a measure on groups. So we will give some meaning to this type of expressions, where, for instance, U is the unitary group. So for instance, imagine that I want to sum over all the possible. So I start from some state psi zero, and I rotate it by U.
What is U?
It's a unitary matrix. So U is the unitary group. And then I sum over all of this. And if I define this measure in a normalized way, you see that this is the average state. So it's a way to take averages, right? As you know, measure theory and probability theory are one and the same thing. So taking averages or weighing things is the same thing. So we will explore the properties of the R integral later in this course, but we need a lemma. The lemma is this, is imagine I take the R measure, not on all the unitary transformations in the full space, but only on S. Okay? So I will have unitaries that are unitaries on S. Then these things, I need to complete them with the identity on S bar. Okay? And now I have some operator here. And now I have the dagger of this. Okay? So imagine I want to do this integral. And the operator that I want to integrate by averaging it just on S. So you see, I am rotating it in S and summing over all these possible rotations. But I only touch it on S. Will be our guy, OA of t. And the result of this thing is that on S, where I am averaging it, we get something that is, since I'm averaging over all the possible operators, we actually are obtaining something that is like the mixed state. In fact, let me say, with a very slight abuse, but I'm not making actually any mistake, that on S, we get the identity on S over the S. On S bar, so on the rest, I'm not doing anything. So I would like to have OA of t as it should be on S bar. And I know right now I'm waving my hands. We will prove these things. Okay, this is OA of t on S bar. So, and how do I make it on S bar? I trace out S. So you see that this is exactly what we define as OA L of T. So my wannabe good truncated operator can be obtained by taking the full operator and averaging over S. Okay, so we will prove expressions like this, but right now let's use it. Okay, so now we are concerned with finding an upper bound to this, right, and showing that it is very small. So let's do that. So this will be smaller or equal than, so now I will plug in this result. Okay? So I will write this as the integral in dUS, and then I will have US OA of T U dagger S minus OA of T in norm. And you see that right now, I'm actually using my abuse of notation. I'm not putting my identities, but at this point, it should be clear. And why I get an upper bound? Because I put the norm under the integral, so I use the triangular inequality. So that's why we have an upper bound. Okay? Okay. So you know that I can multiply inside the norm everything for any unitary operator, because unitary operator is norm preserving. So if I multiply by, let me see what I used. If I multiply on the right by US inside the norm, I get US OA minus OA US. So this is nothing. But this integral of the norm of the commutator between US and OA of T.
Why can you say the equal sign upper bound?
Because all I did was to multiply this thing by US. And US is norm preserving. These things are inside the norm.
Okay,
yes. I see. Hmm? Okay, good. So we are here. Oh, but now you see that this is US, this is an operator that has support on S, means L away from A. And you know that I can upper bound the commutator between UA, sorry, OA of T and an operator that has support. This is like B, right? I can use my Lib-Robinson bounds, and I can put the distance between S and B, which is L, okay? So this is smaller than 2 times the norm of this, which is 1, the norm of OA, that is OA, and then E to the dt minus L. And we have some, I put L minus, okay. And whatever else was in front on Vt minus L, I define it as C to the minus 1, because it has the dimensions of a length. Do you agree? This is in the exponential, so it must be dimensionless. So whatever is multiplying the thing has the dimensions of a length. Whether we embedded it or it is in graph distance, must be an object of the same type. Okay, well, we're done. So now you see that if Vt is smaller than L, this decays exponentially fast outside L. So this is a good truncation, exactly in the sense of the Lib-Robinson bounds. So you see, I've given you 2 examples of why this commutator, in which at different times, is the object that enters all the interesting properties, like no signaling or the truncation operators. In the notes, so I will not do it here because we are, according to my over-optimistic ideas, half a lecture late with what I want to do. So in the lecture notes, there is one more thing that you can do, and you can do it by yourselves. You know, you just follow the notes, and it is also a bound on the spreading of correlations. Okay, so imagine that you have 2 operators that are correlated only over a distance chi. And I want to correlate over a larger distance by interactions. Okay, I can do that. So I want to add to this correlation length another correlation length psi through interactions. And in order to get another correlation length psi, we will need to wait time t. Otherwise, And away from Xi, we will not get anything. So you can prove that using the same technique. Very good. Okay. So today, and we have two lectures back to back. And what I want to show you is this very important theorem, this theorem of clustering of correlations. It was proven ages ago in 1D by people like Lieb. And people struggled for many years to find a general proof of this theorem, because in fact people believed it very much. They used it all the time because numerics suggested it was true and good sense suggested that it was true, until I think 2006 or 8, I forgot. Anyway, kind of recently Matthew Hastings proved it in the full generality. And in the process of proving it, he rediscovered the Lieb-Robinson bounds that, as cool as they are, they went forgotten. They were proven in the 70s, in the early 70s, and then they were forgotten because people were at the time were not looking at these things with the eyes of today, in which it seems interesting to use bounds on errors that you make in order to argue about the general properties of quantum physics and quantum matter. So now we have this this sensibility. So that's why we actually feel that the Lieb-Robinson bounds are really nice tool. Anyway, so what is the clustering of correlations? Is this theorem that says if we have the ground state, a system whose ground state is unique, so means no degeneracy, so for instance, it cannot be a symmetry broken phase, right? Because when you break a symmetry, it means you have a degeneracy. Is this clear? If there is one thing you have to remember from this course, is this. If you break the symmetry, means that the symmetry operator brings you from one state to another state in the ground state manifold. So they do not commute with the symmetry. Okay. So if the ground state is unique, and there is a gap above the ground state, then there cannot be long-range order, which means Xi is finite. Which is what we learned in the example of the quantum XY model, right? We have exactly this situation. We have two gapped phases, but in the paramagnetic phase, there is no long range order because the ground state is unique. In the symmetry broken phase, if you take the symmetric state, the connected correlation functions are connected over are different from zero over every distance. So there is long range order, so there is no Xi, there is no exponential decay. And we wonder, as we said many times, whether this can be true. Because if this is not true, then this opens up the possibility that you can have a degeneracy and still have Xi. But if you have a degeneracy and non-long-range order, then this cannot be symmetry breaking. Because we know that if you take two symmetry broken states and you superimpose them, then you have a long-range order. So you see why this theorem is so important, because if we understand why this does not need to be true, and in the proof there will be a point where we see it, then this opens up the possibility to a new kind of order, okay, that has completely different features. In fact, this is true. It's called the topological order. It is what we will be exploring from lectures of Friday. Okay. So we want to do this proof because we want to do this. The other reason why we want to do this proof is because, as I said at the beginning, this course is not only about understanding many new things in this interdisciplinary subject called quantum matter, but it's also a way to acquiring some technical tools that you can use in many contexts. So without further ado, let's go on with this proof. Okay, so let me write on this blackboard some identities and some mathematical preliminaries that we will need. So first of all, the Lie-Robinson bounds, okay? So the norm of, the norm of commutator between AT and B, upper bounded by this exponential. And if you remember the derivation of the Lie-Robinson bounds, at some point, we upper bounded the number of paths between A and B with the total number of paths, right? This was a very gross overestimate. Now, because the number of paths is an integer, since this is an upper bound, a strict upper bound, it actually becomes a less or equal upper bound if I just subtract to the number f subtract 1. If the total number of paths is greater than the total number of paths between A and B, this means the total number of paths is at least greater or equal the total number of paths between A and B minus 1. As a consequence, one can cast. So I didn't do this, this is a very petty specification because, in fact, it is more than just one. And it doesn't play any role in the proofs that we did so far. But today we need this thing. So one is able to cast the Lie-Robinson bounds in this form. Where this mu is contains everything else that was not in B. Okay, contains A, contains alpha. Okay. If I didn't have this one, I would have the usual Lie-Robinson bound, E to the mu, Vt minus D. So mu is what I called before xi to the minus one.
Yes.
But I have this minus one here. This still works. This is still a bound.
Is V here the same?
V is the Lie-Robinson speed. Okay. So this is the first point. Second point, we need some mathematical preliminaries. Many of these tools are very well known to you, so. But let me put them on the blackboard. We will make a lot of use of the Fourier transform that in this context I will use in this form. So if I have some function f of t, I will call its Fourier transform either capital F of f of t or hat f of omega. sometimes I will forget the hat. This is something that in physics people do all the time. You know it's the Fourier transform because I'm using omega. And this is defined as, so I will define this one without 1 over square root of 2 pi. And I will define the anti-Fourier transform which is of course f of t as 1 over 2 pi I don't know why when I wrote the notes I did it in this way, I forgot. Probably at some point I will make a version of the notes in which I can do the same proof with a more symmetric definition. That doesn't really matter. Yeah?
Your new one is much unnatural for me because when t is very small, this bound, this subtraction is a very big subtraction when t is very small. I mean,
no, that's fine, but we know that the Lib-Robinson bounds, we only like them when t is large.
Why?
Because the whole point when t is, when vt is greater than d. We already know that when vt is smaller than d, we have something large. So it doesn't matter if it is larger. The only meaning of the Lib-Robinson bounds is outside the light cone. We really don't care what happens inside the light cone.
Okay, so
inside the light cone, anything goes.
Then d should be large, right?
Huh?
D should be large, but when d is small, then t can be small. I mean, the distance between.
So t, well, vt must be larger than d.
But d can be small. D can also be small.
Sure.
Yeah, so then when D is small, T is small, then when T is small, this.
Well, if V is small and T is small, means you are inside a light cone.
No, D. Yes, so. But. I'm a bit confused that you are saying we are outside light cone. So outside light cone should be vt smaller than.
So this has to be weighed with mu, right?
Yes.
So mu has the meaning of the inverse of a length. So this is only saying that if your v and t are so small that you are already inside your correlation length, which is the minimum possible length, is basically the length of the elementary interactions, then of course you are inside the light cone. Because it's the minimum distance at which you can act.
Sorry, which is in which light cone? Yeah, I think B is in A light cone.
So VT defines a light cone. Right?
Sure, the A is light cone. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
B is small, B is definitely not in his light cone.
So you are concerned with this thing being close to zero?
Yes.
Yeah. So this means that VT is very large with respect to Xi.
Oh.
Xi is 1 over mu.
Yes.
And this Xi has basically the meaning of the elementary interactions. Then yes, of course. I understand your point. So if vt is very small, means that mu is very large.
We don't need know mu large or not. We need.
Well, but you are afraid that this goes to zero.
Yes.
Okay. So if mu is very large.
Yes.
it means that psi is very small.
Yes.
Okay. So sorry, I was flipping what I should have been saying. This means that even for very small t, we are outside of the light cone, because basically we are in the continuous limit. And in the continuous limit, we know it goes to zero, and this is exactly what you're saying, seeing that it goes to zero in the continuous limit. Yes. So saying that Bt is very small is the same thing of saying that A is very small.
So what I'm concerned...
It's the continuous limit, and we are fine. We know that in the continuous limit, A, T, and B...
Yes, I mean, before subtraction, it is one, nearly 1 when T is 0. But after subtraction, it is 0. So it is changed by 100%. So this is very large subtraction. I mean,
mm-hmm.
You cannot hand-waving show that is... Right, and also you show that, yes, it's far not that obvious to me.
Okay, no, so I completely agree with you. I tried to give a justification of why one can rederive the Libby-Robinson bounds in this form. It's a justification because I didn't just want to write the formula, and at the same time, I didn't want to redo the whole derivation because it's almost, you know, there is not much more to learn. Only at some point you have to count the parts in a different way. And I try to give a justification as to why this makes sense, but believe me, this can be proven.
Okay, I see.
Okay? But so what is inside this is that this only works for when we are when Bt is not too small with respect to your lattice spacing, because this is the case in which we are interested.
Okay.
So I agree that maybe it fails when in other cases, but. We will not go there. Okay, so here we have our Fourier transforms. And then we have convolution. Between two functions, f and g. And what is the convolution? So what you do is that you take your functions, f and g, say that they are function of t. You multiply them and integrate between minus infinity and plus infinity. But what you do is that you first reflect f, and then you shift it of some x. So of course, now, if you do that, the result of this integral depends on x. Okay, so this is convolution. And the convolution has a very interesting behavior with respect to the Fourier transform, because the Fourier transform of a convolution is equal to the ordinary product of the Fourier transforms, whereas the Fourier transform of the ordinary product is equal 1 over 2 pi, because of my definition, of the convolution of the two functions. Sorry, of the convolution of the Fourier transforms. Okay. And let me also now write two Fourier transforms that we will be using a lot. And when two functions are related by Fourier transform, I will use this symbol. Okay, so the Gaussian function in Fourier transform becomes, again, as you know, a Gaussian function, but with this weight. And the delta function is related to the theta function, which is the step function, in this way. So let me put the theta on this side. So the theta function in the frequency domain is equal to pi delta function minus I over t, which we will call the Fourier transform of the theta. And this is a function of t. OK. And now we have two lemmas that if I prove it will take me an hour, so I put the proof in the notes. Okay, lemma one is basically a lemma on the behavior of the error function. And lemma two is a simple lemma. Okay, so lemma one says, imagine that we have some variable e, which can be either upper bounded or lower bounded by some quantity delta. So we have two cases. One is that E is upper bounded, sorry, lower bounded by delta. Let me see which one I'm doing first. No, I'm first doing, yeah. And the second case is when E is lower bounded by delta. So in the first case, if I compute this object, 1 over 2 pi, the integral between minus infinity and plus infinity of the Fourier transform of the theta function evaluated at minus t times e to the minus e I e t with the Gaussian envelope. Okay. So this integral is equal to 1 plus a function that scales in this way. So I will write order of. By order of means that there can be a prefactor times this function. E to the minus delta square over 4 alpha. In the case two, you don't have the one. If you follow the proof in the notes, you will see that at some point it boils down on known inequalities between the error function with the error function or with the complementary error function, and there is a one, because one is one minus the other. Lemma two is something simpler, is this simple inequality. If I take the function e to the x, sorry, minus 1 over x in dx, I integrate it between minus infinity and a. This is upper bounded, so this is okay, this is upper bounded by e to the a minus e to the minus a, which is something of the order of e to the a. Okay, so these are instruments that we will need, so let me now put them up there. Okay. So we want to show, so let's go back to our main topic. We want to show that psi is finite. Okay? So we want to put an upper bound to the connected correlation functions between A and B in the ground state. So this is what we want to upper bound. Now, without loss of generality, we can, this makes the proof simpler, we can place ourselves in the case in which these expectation values are actually zero. Why I can do that? Because if I have a case where this is not true, I can just redefine my operator A as A minus its minus this, and then, you know, I prove it for that one. Okay? So this is B0, 0, and this is 0. Okay. So this means that actually I just want to bound this, the non-connected part. Okay, so let's see how we do that. Our starting point is the commutator between AT and B. And its expectation value in the ground state. Okay. So you see that here we have time, here we do not have time. Okay. So it is actually worthwhile to to actually explicitly write what is this. Right? We write it in a basis. Okay, so let's do that. And so we would have a sum over all the states of e to the minus I e I t e0i bi0. This is for atb. And then we have a minus bat. But this comes as, it does come with a plus here. And it is e to the EIT B0I AI0. Okay. And now remembering that A00 and B00 are 0, I can just make my sum from, I can exclude 0. Okay, I go from 1 onwards.
Why is there a plus?
A very good question. It could be a typo in my notes. I need to check because I see a minus 2. Yeah, I can put them. Anyway, this will not play. Maybe they put the plus. Anyway, this will not be important, I think. Let's see. Okay. Okay, so this is something we need to check later, okay? Yeah.
Isn't there also a... Shouldn't be EI minus E0 or we?
Okay, so well, you know what? Let's just do that. Okay? So what we have here is E to the IHT A E to the minus IHT B minus B E to the IHT A e to the minus IHT between 0 and 0. Okay, so now we want to write this thing like the sum over L e to the I e L T L L, and then we have A here. we have m, and here now we have minus em t, okay? And then now we have b here, okay? And now we sandwich everything with the zero. So this is the first term, okay? So here we have, using this delta, we have A0M, and here we have BM0. Okay. And now L is equal to zero, okay? And I can put this energy to zero. So here I have just the sum over M of e to the minus I E L T. Okay. So this gives me this part, right? Okay. So if now we do the same thing on the other side, I don't think we get rid of that minus, so we should have exactly that. Okay. All right, okay. So notice that this object will be just this. Do you agree? So you see that I think I know how to bound this, right? Because I could use my Lib-Robinson bounds. But I want to bound this. So how do I go from here to here? So let's look at this. It means that I am doing two things. First of all, I first need to get rid of this, of the negative frequency part. Second, once I've got rid of this negative frequency part, I need to send the t to zero. Okay? So if I do this, this object will be what I want to bound. Okay? So one thing that I can do, so let me write what I just said. This object, so how do I do mathematically these things? First of all, how do I get rid of the negative frequency part? Well, what I will do is that I take my object, my commutator, evaluated in zero in the ground state. I first Fourier transform it, so that now it is a function in omega. Then what do? Then I filter out the negative frequency with the step function. The step function is zero for omega negative, and this one for omega positive. And then I go back to my time domain, okay? So this operation that I said with the hands, I said, I erase this, and then I take, I erase this is this operation, then I must take t equals zero. Okay. Once I'm back to the time domain, I take t equals zero. Okay. So this is the object that we want to bound. So let's see what happens to this object, okay?
It should be theta minus omega.
Huh?
Theta minus omega, because in your definition of Fourier transformation, the omega, the e, I mean, the first.
No, I think I'm okay.
Okay, okay.
I think I'm okay. All right. Okay. Okay, so now let's do some calculations, okay? Let's see how we can bound this object. Okay, so this is equal to... Okay, the first thing that I want to do is that here, as you can see, I have the product of two Fourier transforms, right? Because theta of omega is the Fourier transform of theta hat, and f of that is that, right? So the product of two Fourier transforms is equal to the Fourier transform of the convolution. Okay, so let me write that. So I will have 1 over 2 pi theta hat t convoluted 0 a of t b 0 at t equals 0. Because what happened is that then I have the f of minus 1 of that, right? So I get to this. Do you see? Okay. So now let's write this convolution. So this is going to be equal 1 over 2 pi, the integral between minus infinity plus infinity. And then we have 0 a of t prime b 0, and now this is the function that I'm shifting. I shift it of t, and I integrate in t prime. So now this is a function of t, and I will take, evaluate it at t equals 0. Okay. So now you see that what this this means. So what is this theta hat? What does it do? Is pi delta of t minus I over t. So the delta part means that t becomes 0. So when I integrate it, I have 1 over 2 pi minus infinity. I don't see that. No, let me leave it. Let me leave it in the form of theta hat. Let me just take t equals 0. So just put t equals 0 here. So what I will have is just this integral in t prime, right? So a, well, now that I have only the integral in t prime, I change the name of this variable to t. And this is theta of minus t in the t. Okay, very good. Okay. Okay, so now it is in a form that we would like to use because we managed to write our correlation functions because this equal is here. So let me connect them. right? So this was a way to obtain in my correlation function. So let me put this expression in a box. As something that contains the commutator. Okay. So if we could bound this with the Lib-Robinson bounds, we will be done. We would be done, right? What's the problem? Yeah?
Sorry, it's time for the break.
It's time for a break. Okay. So we'll resume exactly from this point. Okay.